I'm going to ask you a question. I think I know the answer. In fact, if you don't answer yes, I'm going to wonder if you're lying. Have you ever had any really big challenges in your life, like a really difficult decision that you had to make? I'm going to guess the answer is yes. And in any case, has one of those decisions been the situation of success is not guaranteed? And if I try this, it might not actually work. You know, you're not choosing between two good things. In some cases, you might be choosing between kind of, do I just kind of stay where I'm at? Or I decide to do something that might not work, but it's important enough to try to do that. You know, and it can come in a lot of forms, right? You know, depending on kind of where you are in your life, you know, you may have a situation of thinking about starting a business, and upwards of 80% of new businesses fail. But are you going to be willing to try and do that and see how that goes? Or try to advance in your job, or even from a volunteering standpoint, step out to do something that's new, that's different, that you don't know if it's really going to be a fit for you. You know, or for folks who've retired, think back to that time when you made that decision to retire. You know, although you may have been looking forward to retirement, I imagine that there were things that were scary about that. Like, how's life going to work after I do this? And if you're a person who finds your identity in your job, what's it like to let that go and live a new phase of life? You know, or I think one of the really challenging ones that many of us will face at some point is that we have a medical issue. And the doctor says, well, here's a treatment that's available, but I'm not sure it's going to do everything you need. Do you want to try it or not? And you have to kind of struggle through that decision. Right? The reality is that life is filled with those kind of decisions. Hopefully, you don't face one of those every day. But from time to time, we do face those. But I think the thing that we find that if we're going to get kind of all we can out of our lives, that when we face those challenges, we need to be willing to step into them sometimes, even though the outcome isn't guaranteed. And honestly, if we're going to do all we can with our lives, the bigger thing, we need to be willing to do things that are scary and that might not work. And this is really kind of, this idea is the basis of what we're going to talk about today in our series, right, that we called Beating the Odds, right, where we talk about the story of Esther. And remember that we kind of broke it down into kind of three parts. If we look at the way Esther deals with her difficult decisions, there's kind of three parts, right? There's first what I call the facts part. You know, in other words, look at the facts. What is the reality here? Because in difficult situations, there is a big temptation to not look at reality. Whoa, that part's too scary. I'm going to ignore it. Or, you know, I don't want to think about that part. So we got to look at the facts. And in any situation, there are things that we cannot control, right? In medical issues, there's lots of stuff we can't control. But as we talked about last week, even in terms of our jobs or volunteering, people well above us can make a decision that brings that to an end. You can't control that. I can't control that. I mean, the reality is that we can't control the biggest things in life. Not really, right? You can live a healthy life, but you can't change your genetics, sort of thing. So for all those sort of things, we want to make sure we're leaning on our faith, that we're going to trust God, that we're going to recognize that there are things that we just have to turn over to God. And then the last one is the one I had called fight last week. And when I said that, you know, my point was is that when you're facing a challenging situation, you're going to lean into it with all you have. I don't mean it as a combative situation. But as I told you last week, I didn't really love that word fight, but I couldn't think of anything better. Well, now that it's recorded on video, I came up with something better. So we're going to cross out fight and call it focus. And if you actually look at the story of Esther, that's a much more accurate description. You'll see that Esther continually moves forward in spite of incredible challenges, not because she's combative, because she actually figures out how to be successful without being combative, that she can pour herself into it by focusing on the way forward, and how to get things done. And we'll actually see today as we get into it that she's faced with that sort of thing again. And as I told you last week, that she was in a really difficult situation, but for her, the stakes keep getting higher. And we'll see this week the stakes are much higher for her this time than they were last time. So just as a quick reminder, right, we're going through the book of Esther. The book of Esther was written or the events in the book of Esther are from about 500 years before Jesus. So about 2,500 years ago. Esther's a young girl. You know, we're going to guess she was probably in her teens because that's kind of when you married off women 2,500 years ago. And we know that she's part of the nation of Israel, but the nation of Israel has been under conquered leadership for centuries at this point. And currently, the Persians are in charge. And so she has the difficulty of being a nation that doesn't really have its own identity because they're living under the Persians. We know that she's an orphan, that both of her parents have died at some point, that she's now living with a cousin, a guy named Mordecai. Mordecai, we believe, loves her a great deal, loves her like she is his own child. But the reality is that for Esther, life has just been difficult. And as we saw last week, things kind of got turned up for her. That was what was already a difficult life got worse. Because the king decides he wants to go find the queen. And you remember how he did it? We'll call it a beauty contest. But what it is that he basically sends his minions out to go collect all the beautiful young women throughout his vast empire to try out to be his queen. And remember how this works. If you were called into this contest, you have no choice about it. If they say you're going, you're going. And you are never coming back home. Right? For one girl, she would prevail and become queen. But for every other girl, they would basically be locked away in the palace, for all intent and purposes, prisoners. Yes, they would have shelter, they would have food, but their lives would never be their own. And Esther gets pulled into this. And as we saw, despite incredible odds, Esther prevails. And Esther rises up to become queen of Persia. And we saw that she did that by being willing to do what was difficult, to actually, you know, kind of focus on succeeding at a contest she wants nothing to do with, because none of the choices were good. So she chose the best path she could find. So this week, as we pick up the story, Esther is now queen. And, you know, it's not really the life she wanted, but it's not a terrible life. I mean, the king of Persia is one of the most powerful people alive at this time. And she's his queen. Now, she doesn't have political authority, but she has certainly access to resources, fantastic clothing, food, kind of the best that could be provided. And she's also, it appears to be adept at getting the things done that she can, because she gets her cousin Mordecai a really good job where he actually is part of effectively the king's court. He effectively becomes an elder around the king's. So that means that she and Mordecai can still see each other from time to time. I mean, they just can't just hang out every day sort of thing, but they can get together from time to time. Mordecai is now a respected official in the king's court. So, you know, it's not really the sort of thing that they wanted, but it's okay. And one of the things that happens is that Mordecai's position gives him access to political information, that he is now, you know, not necessarily the innermost trusted people of the king, but he is a trusted member of the king's court. So people talk pretty freely in front of him. He's able to move around very easily. And one of the things that he overhears as he's moving around is that there are two people considering to kill the king, that the king has actually upset two of his attendants. And Mordecai overhears it. So what's Mordecai going to do? Well, the text tells us that Mordecai heard about the plot and gave the information to Queen Esther. Now, your first thought might be, well, of course he did. I mean, Mordecai just can't go running into the king himself, right? But she's queen, so I'll tell her and she'll tell the king. But what we don't realize, or may not realize, is that he took a huge chance by doing that. If you have ever seen any movie, any TV show, read any book that talks about the way ancient kings' courts worked, right, that court, that inner group, they were always about politics. They were always climbing over each other. They were always trying to push ahead of someone else. And if anyone had ever heard Mordecai sharing this information that he knew that someone was going to try to kill the king, if you're willing to kill the king, you think you're willing to kill an attendant along the way while you're at it? Of course. So Mordecai put his own life in danger to share this information with Esther. Now, do you think Mordecai really likes the king? I mean, let's think about their history. Do you think Mordecai's a huge fan of the king? I'm going to bet no. So why would he do this? Why not just let the king die? What happens to the wife of the previous king when the new king comes in? Best case, she's locked up. More likely, you clean house. You just kill everybody. And so he cares about Esther. So he's willing to put his own life at risk for a chance at saving her life. Now, fortunately, he's successful in doing this. And we find out that Esther then told the king about it and gave Mordecai credit for the report. So now the king knows someone's trying to kill him. In fact, he knows exactly who's trying to kill him. And he knows it's thanks to Mordecai that he has this information. Now, the king deals with those who are trying to kill him the way you would expect him to. They're not a problem anymore. but this does kind of work out for Mordecai, right? Because now Mordecai is kind of endeared to the king. Now, you know, keep in mind the king's not going to suddenly see Mordecai as an equal, right? Again, they're not beer buddies sort of thing. But obviously the king is going to have a more favorable view of Mordecai. So now it seems like things are going pretty sweet, right? You know, Esther's queen. She's clearly figuring out how to get things done. She's able to talk to her husband, the king. Mordecai's got a good job, right? He's got respect. He's got the appreciation of the king. Easy street, because that's how your life works, right? That when things go well, it's just good from now on out. Eventually, something comes along. And we don't want to be doom and gloomers, but the reality is that at some point in our lives, something else will eventually come along that throws a wrench in the works. Well, for Esther and Mordecai, that wrench has a name. It's a guy named Haman. And Haman is this very politically adept person who actually knows how to work his way through the inside of the court. Right? For Mordecai, this wasn't really his native environment. Right? You know, he would do his job well, but he never really had ambitions, as far as we can tell, of trying to rise up. But that's what Haman lives for. And so the text tells us that sometime later, King Xerxes promoted Haman, son of Hammedatha. I've been looking forward to saying that out loud all day. Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, over all the other nobles, making him the most powerful official in the empire. So what that means is that in their structure, that means that all of a sudden this guy Haman is more powerful than every single person in the kingdom except for the king himself. It's an extraordinary level of power. And he's like, well, is that good or bad? I don't know. Well, it says that he's an Agagite. Do you know what an Agagite is? The only place in the entire Bible that word shows up is in the book of Esther. And the background on it is that there was a kingdom that was led like 500 years earlier. There was a kingdom, the kingdom of the Ammonites, I believe it is. And the king was Agag, and he lived to wipe out the nation of Israel. So if you call someone an Agagite, that means it's someone who hates people who are Jewish, people who are from Israel. Basically, we'd call them an anti-Semite today. And so now, all of a sudden, the person who is in charge of the entire kingdom, except for the king being slightly over him, is someone who hates the nationality that Mordecai is. And it's one of the things that we learn about Haman is he loves power. And he loves all the trappings, all the attention that he gets because of his power. And something happens when the king appoints Haman. It says that all the king's officials would bow down before Haman to show him respect whenever he passed by, for so the king had commanded. So the king said that, this is my guy, Haman's my guy, so I want you to show him respect. If he walks by, I want you to bow down to him. And Haman loves that. But if you're Mordecai, and you know what kind of person this is, and what that name being an Agagite, or Agagite, means, are you going to bow down to him? Says that Mordecai refused to bow down or show him respect. In other words, like, you know, I know what this guy really is. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to pretend that he's okay. Yes, I respect my king, and I know the king has ordered it, but not for this guy. I'm not going to do it. And for Haman, like, that's like one of the most offensive things you can do to him. That I want people to bow down and show me respect. I want people to know who I am. And as we continue through the story later, we'll see that he just lives for that kind of stuff. But when Haman saw that Mordecai would not bow down or show him respect, he was filled with rage. I mean, could you imagine that? Like, just completely blowing your top because some guy who ranks far below you just won't bow down to you? And it turns out that basically Haman starts trying to think of ways he can hurt Mordecai. That he actually really wants to, you know, kind of do him in. But we find out as Haman thinks about it, he actually comes up with an idea he likes even better. Said Haman learned of Mordecai's nationality. So he decided it was not enough to lay hands on Mordecai alone. Instead, he looked for a way to destroy all the Jews throughout the entire empire of Xerxes. In other words, he is such a racist that he decides, because this one guy has committed an offense, I finally had the excuse I need to get rid of that entire nation, that I want to wipe every single person out. Now, how's Haman going to pull this off? Because still technically, the entire nation of Israel are still subjects of the king. So if Haman was just on his own to go out there and start wiping them all out, the king's probably going to frown on that a little bit. He has no particular compassion for that one particular group, but the king wouldn't just tolerate any of his officials deciding to wipe out an entire section of his kingdom. So what can he do? Remember I said that Haman is very, very adept at politics. He knows how to get things done. So what he does is he comes up with a plan to motivate the king. And this is a plan that you will be very familiar with. The fear of those people. You know, the people who are different than you, the people who don't live like you do, the people who don't go about their lives as you do. Their beliefs aren't the same as yours. If you ever watch cable news, you've seen it in practice. Right? There are podcasts that live off this sort of thing. There are blog posts that live off this sort of thing. And cable news on both sides lives off this sort of thing. And it works today. And you know what? It worked 2,500 years ago as well. Because Haman can't walk in and say, I want to wipe out the nation of Israel. Because the king knows that that nation is what Mordecai is from. And he can't even say, I want to kill Mordecai's people. Because again, the king likes Mordecai. So what Haman actually does is he goes into the king. He says, King, you know, I don't know if you know this, but there's a group of people in your kingdom. And they don't believe the way we do. They don't act the way we do. They kind of live separate by themselves. Now, he never says who those people are, because he doesn't have to. They're different. And, you know, if you don't deal with those people who are different than you, you know what they're doing? They're coming for yours. They're going to take you down. And Haman does a really good job of it. And as far as we can tell, he's kind of selling the king on this whole idea. King never bothers to ask who those people are. But again, I've said Haman is very politically adept. And so he's not going to leave any of this to chance. So he adds one other thing. After he lays out this scary group of unnamed people who are different, he then adds, and if it please the king, issue a decree that they be destroyed. And I will give 10,000 large sacks of silver to the government administrators to be deposited in the royal treasury. Now, for context, Bible commentaries say that that is probably about worth 8 months of income for the kingdom. So he's basically approached the king saying that, hey, you know, I am so loyal to you that I'm willing to do the dirty work and get rid of this unnamed group of people who are different. And I am so loyal to you that I want to give you an extra 8 months worth of income just because I'm loyal. Now, you might think that, well, the king is so rich, you know, and wealthy, why would he care? Well, keep in mind that Xerxes is a real person, and he's actually documented in the history books. And what we know from the history books is that, first of all, we do know that Xerxes mostly inherited his wealth. And we know about the time frame of the Book of Esther that he's actually lost some significant battles. And so he's kind of pulling out of the battle business a little bit. And he decides he's more of a builder. So he wants to start building these huge construction projects. And the history books tell us that he was actually spending tremendous amounts of money on these construction projects. And to the point that we know that later he kind of begins to bankrupt the kingdom. The history books tell us that. So Haman knows that the way to get the king is, hey, I'm going to wipe this unnamed group of people out. And you know that building project you're so proud of? Let me pay for one of those for you. And so it works. He frames all this as loyalty to the king. And the king falls for it. Because the king says, well, Haman, you know, the money and the people are both yours to do with as you see fit. In other words, do what you like. I'll let it go. So what that means is that Haman has just received permission to commit genocide for an entire nation of people. So what he does is that he is now going to draw up what we call an edict, and actually an order, to actually say that we're going to go out there and we're going to authorize the wiping out of all the Jewish people in the entire kingdom. But it seems that although the king says it's okay, we don't know exactly why this is the case, but it seems that the king may have wanted to say that, okay, you can do that, but I don't want anarchy. So if you're going to wipe all these people out, you got to do it all in one day. Now, that would be a tremendous effort, right? Haman can't do that by himself, but Haman never does anything himself anyway, right? He figures out how to get other people to do it. So what he decides to say is that, okay, well, we'll put the order out, and on that date, anybody who kills those people, you can have their property. So he's used finances to motivate the king. He's used finances to motivate the execution. But now, Haman appears to be a little bit superstitious, though. He wants to be sure that they pick the right day. So they do what's called casting lots. It's also, you also call them pur, or P-U-R. Basically, it's like rolling dice, but you believe the fates are on your side. So what you do is you cast lots, effectively roll dice to pick a date, believing that the fates are guiding you towards the best date. And so in that, they actually end up with a date that's about a year away, almost a full year away. So they write the edict that says that on this date, about a year from now, every member of the kingdom is authorized to kill anyone who's part of the nation of Israel, and you can have their stuff if you do it. And this goes out. Now, how do you think that felt to all the people who were part of Israel, all the Jewish people in the area? Because they would have gotten it too. So can you imagine someone sending you a letter, and you open your mail, and they tell you that, what is this? This is, May 26th? So on May 3rd, I'm just picking a date, we're going to burst in your house, kill your whole family, and take your stuff. But you say hi to them every day as you walk by, or as you're cutting your lawn, or as you head to the store. You see those people eyeing you up, the ones that are trying to figure out if you're one of the weak ones or not, one of the easy kills. That's what the people were living with in that time frame. So as you might expect, the Jewish people throughout the nation were in mourning, right? We don't know what we're going to do. That we don't have the strength to defend ourselves against a wave of people that large. And Mordecai knows that he's going to get caught up in this, that he's one of the ones who will be killed as well, because the edict doesn't say that political officials are protected. Now again, the king's not aware this is the case, but Mordecai's aware this is the case. Now, while all this is going on, Esther's completely unaware. Remember last week that Esther never reveals to people where she's from. So no one thinks this impacts her. Again, she's not involved in the politics of things, so no one tells her stuff normally anyway. In this particular issue, they don't think it affects her, so they don't tell her anything. The first news that she hears is someone comes in and gives her a report that your cousin Mordecai's out there, and he's dressed in like his funeral clothes, and he's throwing ashes on his head, and he's wailing in the streets. And she has no idea why. Now, again, I said she actually has privilege but not power. She is not permitted to leave the palace for her protection, of course, right? So she's not allowed to go out. So she sends one of her servants out, ones that she trusts, to ask Mordecai what's going on. In fact, what she actually does is she sends a set of clothing out to Mordecai, saying, switch out of your funeral clothes and come in so I can talk to you. Because there's a rule in the palace that no one in funeral clothes can come in because, you know, we don't want to upset the king, sort of thing. And Mordecai is kind of hard-headed because he's like, nope, I'm not taking these off. That this is a time of mourning. I am not changing out of these clothes. And it creates this kind of really weird exchange that they have to have. You know, he couldn't grab his cell and call her, right? You know, he couldn't send her a text. So what they end up doing is that he and Esther end up sending messages using the servant. And some of these messages were rather lengthy. And so as the servant comes and says, well, if you won't come in, what do you want me to tell her? And Mordecai lays it all out. He says that, you know, an order has been written to have all of the people of Israel killed. That money has been paid to the king to make sure this actually happens. It's going to happen through the entire nation, including the city we're in right now. And he also sends along a copy of the edict so that she knows the details. She knows he's not making it up. And as he does all this, he also includes what would be a terrifying request to Esther. He says to Esther, this is on you. You've got to fix this. You've got to go to the king. You've got to beg for mercy. Tell him that they are your people, and they're going to be impacted by this. Now, to us, that sounds completely reasonable, right? You're the queen. Go talk to the king. But it turns out that things aren't quite that simple. And Esther makes clear a couple things as she responds back to Mordecai. So after Mordecai sends all this information to Esther through the servant, Esther sends this back through the servant. She says, all the king's officials and even the people in the provinces know that anyone who appears before the king in his inner court without being invited is doomed to die unless the king holds out his gold scepter. Now, what's going on there? Now, next week we'll talk about what the issue is with the inner court and the outer court because there's some important things that happen there. But the key thing to understand about the inner court, it's kind of the king's inner sanctum, his place of safety and security. So the assumption of his security people is that if anyone walks through that door that was not invited, they must intend harm to the king. So their orders are, if anyone walks through that door and they weren't invited, kill them instantly, including the queen. And the only way to interrupt that is if the king decides, prior to them pulling their swords out, that this is someone he wants to see. And simply holds a scepter up saying, no, this one's okay. And the king's a moody person. If you read through the whole book of Esther, you know, on any given day, you don't know if he's going to let you in or not. And so that's what she's dealing with. But then she adds one more thing. The king has not called for me to come to him for 30 days. In other words, I know when I first got here, the king was throwing these huge parties and he was showing me off and I was kind of the most wonderful thing. Well, some time has gone by and I'm not the king's only wife. And besides all his wife, he's got lots of girlfriends too. And it would seem that he's finding those more interesting than me right now. So not only am I putting my life at risk if I try to talk to him, he doesn't even seem to care about me right now. So in case you're wondering, that's what my life looks like right now. Now, as she sends this response back, Mordecai's not happy about it. Keep in mind that Mordecai was willing to risk his life to save hers. Right? When he learned about the murder, he was willing to risk his own life to get that information to her so she would be safe. And he knows that he's asking Esther to potentially risk her life, that it is dangerous to approach the king without being invited. But this is to save the life of thousands. So basically, Mordecai's not asking her to do anything that he hasn't already done. And the stakes are far higher for her. That if she is unsuccessful, she will die. But if she But not only will she die, well, thousands of other people will die as well. But if she is successful, she could bring this all to an end. So basically, Mordecai responds. And this is the key thing. And this is the key thing I want you to take away from this message, is that, you know, I've done a lot of build-up, a lot of kind of storytelling around what's going on in Esther's life. But if you've been sleeping through the rest of it, hear this last part, because this is the lesson for us. This is the thing we can pick up and apply in our own lives. Because Mordecai responds that she has to take action. It says, Mordecai sent this reply to Esther. Don't think for a moment that because... Oops, I lost my place, sorry. Sorry, here I go. Don't think for a moment that because you're in a place at the palace, you will escape when all the other Jews are killed. In other words, don't think just because you're safe now, you're going to stay safe. Just don't think because they're not coming for you right now, they won't come for you. Just because this affects other people right now, don't think it won't eventually affect you. Ignoring this will impact you as well. And he carries on. If you keep quiet at a time like this, deliverance and relief for the Jews will arise from some other place, but you and your relatives will die. Who knows if perhaps you were made queen for just such a time as this? What he's saying is that, first of all, God's going to do what he's going to do. He's saying, I'm confident that God will rescue those people. Do you want to be a part of it or not? And when we look at God's work in the world, and we look at the idea of reaching out and helping people come to know Jesus who don't, those people are going to hear about Jesus or not. Do we want to be part of it? Those people are going to hear about Jesus either way. Do we want to be part of it or not? Right? God's going to do what he's going to do. Do we want to be part of the work that he's doing? Or do we want to sit back and watch someone else do the work? Do we want to be a part of it? And one of the things he's pointing out to Esther is that you're looking at the comfort you have right now. That you're in a safe place, a warm place, a dry place, lots of food. You've got everything you need. You've got resources, position, and opportunity. And you're trying to hide behind that for safety. And he's saying that maybe there's things that were given to you, because everything we have is given to us by God. You think they were given to you for safety. Maybe they were given to you as a platform to go do something, to go make a difference. He spells out to Esther, what are you going to use the things that God has given to you? Will you rest in your safety and your comfort? Or will you take a chance and step out and do something that impacts other lives? Be part of the work that God is doing. That's the choice that Esther had. And that's the choice that we have with our lives. Right? That we live in relative comfort. I'm not saying everyone's life is easy. I'm not saying everyone has all the money they need. But we can all do something. And we have to choose. Are we going to sit back and be comfortable? Are we going to do what's familiar because we like it? Are we going to do what we need to because we'll make a difference? Are we going to stay here where we're comfortable, or are we going to walk out into the noise and the chaos? And you know what? It might not work. But we know what doesn't work is doing nothing. That's the choice that we all have with our lives. To use what God has given us to do something, or use what God has given us to remain comfortable. And as Mordecai says this to Esther, she finally gets it. And she lays out, she fully implements in this next few statements, this kind of anchoring point we have for the message, the facts, faith, and focus. Because she sends back this reply. So she's sending this back to Mordecai. Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa, which is just the city that they're in. So go gather all the Jews in the city, and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it's against the law. And if I perish, I perish. What's she doing? Right? She's looking at the facts. She's looking at her reality, the issues that she's dealing with. She knows that this is not guaranteed to be successful. Right? She leans hard on her faith. Because basically, she talks about fasting. What she's saying is that, okay, Mordecai, pray for me. Go pull other people together that you know. All of you, pray for me. I'll do the same thing with my friends. So she's leaning hard on her faith. But she's not just praying and waiting. Because she waits three, he takes 3 days. What do you think she does in that 3 days? She decides how she's going to go to the king. You know, she's going to kind of wander the king and just kind of grovel as she goes in. Is she going to show up as the queen? What's she going to say to him? What's her first words going to be? How is she going to make sure he raises that scepter when she walks through the door? How does she want to make sure that he's happy and excited to see her? She starts planning. She focuses on her opportunity for success. And that's what we need to do in whatever we undertake. Look at the reality. Trust the God, the part we can't control. Pray to God for guidance and direction. But also use the gifts and abilities and resources that you've been given to put together a plan and to execute that plan. So for Esther, after 3 days of preparation, 3 days of prayer, she goes in to see the king. And we'll find out what happens next week.